Hi. Thank you. Jean is so gracious. I was saying, I don't remember that I kept you waiting, but that would be me. I was like, Ani Nindawe Maganaduk, hello, my relatives. Binesikwe Nijinakaz, Makwa Ndodam, Gababani Kog, Ishkanaganing, and Dunjaba Migwich. Thank you very much for the honor of being here. I did travel far. I pretty much followed Jean, actually. She was in the same place I was. But I was really looking forward to being here, and so I'm very glad to be here because it is such a great moment and such a great conversation for us all to be having. And I am a person that is very much possessed with hope. And, you know, I'm gonna do my best to tell my story a little bit on that. But I just want to say that I was really grateful. I got to stay at the Dowie House last night, and I saw my old friend Christopher McLeod. I just saw Larry. And, you know, of course, Melissa. And, you know, it is nice to be with such friends. And one of the first times I came out here, and I remember Mark and Toby and I were talking about it last night, was for this conference. We didn't decide when it was in 1980 or 1981, which was called Technology Over the Invisible Line. Some of you were probably there, is that right? It was like this conversation about where we are. And it very much beckons to where we are today. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that, and also acknowledge that this reminds me a little bit of Standing Rock in some ways, because there is everybody I've known for 40 years here, right? People I've known for a very long time here. And then there's also people I've just met that represent the next generation, like my niece Niria, who is here, and a lot of the young people who have come. And you know, that's one of the things I noticed of this intersection of this time we're in, when I spent time at Standing Rock in our resistance movement there, and watching this movement that is born there. But I noticed, you know, when I was there, I remember seeing people that I had seen over 40 years and people who I had seen in so many geographical spaces all converged at one place at one time. And I thought about this moment that we are in. And in our prophecies, this moment is really called the time of the seventh fire. And in Anishinaabeg prophecies, we were told, you know, that prophets tell you many things that are going to happen to you. That's what their job is, right? And so they talked about all these times in our existence, and they talked about what would happen, and they talked about when people would come, and some would be good, and some would not be good, and they talked about our things would disappear, and like nobody had any idea that the Smithsonian would haul off a whole village, you know, as well as your old people. You know, we had no concept for that. We had no concept for, you know, disappearing people. And we had no construct for, like, all of that that happened to us as indigenous people. But they talked about this time that would come, the time of the sixth fire. And in that time, they said that we would go and we would find our things. We would begin to find our songs and our ceremonies, and we would bring them home, which I think is part of what they call Nagpra, when you get to bring home your relatives, and you bring home your ancestors, and you bring home your drums, and you bring home your sacred items, and you feast them. You bring back their life. Because when they are cached away in a museum, they're not fed. And so that is what you're seeing, you know, with a lot of our people, is the recovery of who we are. And then they said that this time would come. It was called the time of the seventh fire. And in that time, they said that we as Anishinaabeg people, that's where I'm from, Anishinaabeg territory, that we would have a choice between two paths, and one would be well-worn but scorched, and the other path would not be well-worn, and it would be green, and it would be our choice upon which path to embark. And we would be these people who no longer had historical amnesia. We would be these people who did not have ecological amnesia. We would be these people who knew who we were and would make this choice. And I really believe that that is where we all are, this moment in time where we have this opportunity to make those decisions and to make that choice. And so I think about that, and I think about where we all are, and I know that we come from different places, you know, because that is what this world is. And many of us are travelers. We've traveled. Our genetics have traveled, and some of us, our genetics or our people have stayed in the same place. You know, I'm privileged to live in the same place as my great-great-great-great-greats lived. I'm privileged to harvest wild rice in the same place as my great-great-great-great-greats did. I'm privileged to fish in the same lakes, to net fish and to make maple syrup in the same place, you know, in a sugar bush that is probably a 200-year-old sugar bush, you know, longer, but you could see where our ancestors cared for it for that many years. You know, so that is a big privilege to be someone who gets to live that life, you know, gets to live that life. And I think that, you know, one of the challenges that is so American is that that is not the life that most people have. It's such a transient society. Most people do not live where their grandparents or their great-grandparents live. Many do not know who they were. You know, there is this mythology that created this country, which was predicated on this idea of go west, young man, and find that great frontier. You know, and so that has driven your ancestors. That has driven the society to keep moving someplace. And you know, I think that what we all know is that there is no place else to go. There's no new frontiers. We're done. And it would be really good to become ready and steady where you are, you know. And, you know, we've all seen it. I'm a very privileged woman, and I've traveled far. And I remember one day I was in Pahoa, which is like in the big island of Hawaii. And, you know, I went out there, and, you know, that's kind of like way out there, right? And then there's like all these people that moved there from California. And of course, then they went and they put up their private property signs and, you know, did all this stuff. And I was like, can you just leave that stuff at some point? You know, which is kind of what we need to do. We need to kind of like leave some stuff. We need to quit with that stuff and become present and become connected. And to get over, you know, that whole settler and transience has made people, has reaffirmed not only a historical amnesia, where people do not know the history, you know, of these places, the history of, you know, the stories and the history of this, you know, this land, Omaha King, or the land where I live. They do not know those stories. And it has been convenient in many ways to have this amnesia. But people also have an ecological amnesia. You know, and I think about that a lot. I heard a woman say that. I was at a conference on wild rice, you know, because I come from a people that rice, and we have a migration story that told us to go to the place where the food grows upon the water. And we followed a shell which appeared in the sky over a period of hundreds of years, and we would travel. We had 7 stopping places, and the last stopping place is the place where the food grows upon the water, which is wild rice. So that's where the Anishinaabe people are. You know, we came from the eastern seaboard, you know, in this migration, although we are related to people up here in Northern California. But, you know, that rice was everywhere. And I remember going to this conference in Michigan, and they were talking about that they no longer remembered where the rice was. And they no longer, like, there was a forest there they once heard, you know, and there was something that was there, but they couldn't remember it. You know, and that is what ecological amnesia looks like and feels like and sounds like. And to me, that is what we do not want to have. You know, I'm rankling against that. I do not want to be the people that remember when there was rice there or when there was a fine stand of maple trees there. I want to see them, and I want them to be there for the next generation. And that is really this opportunity that we have, is to be those people that, you know, that do not forget. That do not forget, that know, that are present, and are really the people that are the ancestors that we need, you know. And so in my territory, this place, this time here is known as Onaa Bonagesis, which is the hard-crusted snow moon. And in Minnesota, at this time of year, usually it is the freeze and the thaw. And so it gets that hard crust on your snow, you know, also known as the moon you don't want to do a face plant in the snow, you know. But, you know, it is followed by Iskigami Zigigizis, the maple syruping moon, and then Wabaganagizis, which is the flower moon, Odamanagizis, which is the strawberry moon, Meangizis, the blueberry moon. Then there is the moon that follows that, Manomanakegizis, which is the wild rice-making moon, because that is when we take to our lakes and rivers, and that rice appears each year if we take care of our territory, if we take care of our covenant with the Creator. That rice is always there for us. And then it is followed by Watibagagizis, when the leaves change color moon. That is what it is. That's around September. Benakweogizis, when the leaves fall. Gashkadenogizis, that is the moon when it freezes over. Manitou Geezus Soons, Little Spirit Moon, Gitche Manitou Geezus, the Great Spirit Moon, and Namebiden Geezus, which is the sucker moon, which is a kind of a fish. So, you know, that is the moons that are in our territory. And I think often about that because that is where I live, and I observe that. But I also, like, did you all notice that none of those moons is named after a Roman emperor? Did y'all get that? I just want to say it is possible to have an entire worldview that has nothing to do with empire, and y'all be okay, okay? Just work on that Sir Francis Drake Highway stuff for you. That would, like, really help. I don't have, like, it's not even PTSD, it's like ongoing trauma. You know, it's like, one more time, do we got to call that guy? You know, like, I want to go hang out on Sir Francis Drake Highway. Yeah, I like that. You know, anyway, we won't even get into the naming and claiming problem. You know, but the you know, knowledge of time and the geography of space that, you know, much of California is named after, you know, I mean, is named, you know, naming mountains after, you know, white guys. Like, remarkable thought. Remarkably stupid thought, frankly. You know, I'm nothing against men of any size, but the idea of naming is something as immortal as a mountain after something as mortal as a human, you know, is so baffling to me. You know, and so to me, part of what it is our, you know, in the period when we are enlightening ourselves, it is really time to, you know, to recover the names, recover the places, recover the relationship, recover the time, you know, and recover the love of the ecosystems that we have come to be in. So, you know, in this moon now, Ona Bana Geezus, in the time of climate change, the sap has run already. And it is running again. I'm going home to haul sap in our sugar bush, you know, and I hauled it. But one of my my elders, that tells a story, because I always wondered, and Melissa, probably you know this, that maple tree is called a Ninitag, which means a man tree. And I could never understand where that was. Like, I ask, you know, and then you know, because I'm like many of you, someone who likes to hear and collect and listen to the stories that explain my reality, you know, or my language or my place. And I you know, it is called that because our ancestors are buried there. And when the sap comes through the roots take our ancestors, and then our ancestors nourish us through the sap that becomes the sugar and the maple syrup. And that is why it is called the man tree. Is that cool or what? So that is, like, really the essence, I think, in many ways of what we are talking about, the relationship between place and ancestors, the present, you know, and the future, you know, and I, you know, I'm reminded that. And so that is why in the spring we fast and we go take to our sugar bush and we walk and watch spring awaken and are nourished by our ancestors and remember that time and that place. And each place has a story, I'm sure, that is like that. That is my story from my place. And so, you know, I think about that and how our land remembers this, and it is a magical land. And, you know, I'm going to tell you a story of, you know, as I think about what kind of a person I want to be. And, you know, many years ago, you know, I'm in my travels, I lived up in northern Canada for a number of years. I was married to a Cree family way up north on James Bay. And I remember I used to eat sturgeon all the time. And you have sturgeon here in some of your rivers, right? But I loved them so much. I was like, I found them 230 million years old, the most mystical and amazing of fish. You know, like, that's some old dudes, right? I was like, wow, they are so cool, you know? And then I was home, and my reservation and my territory, which is the headwaters of the Mississippi and the headwaters of the Red River. And I said, where are our sturgeon? Where are our sturgeon? And, you know, I you know, began to hear this story that they all were here, but the last one was taken in 1924 off our reservation in White Earth Lake. And, you know, about that time, I was going up to Canada for some ceremonies to see my friend, the great Al Hunter. And Al Hunter has having a ceremony, and I went to see him. He's, you know, across that. We call that the medicine line, the border, because it's like so... You know, we Anishinaabeg people are on both sides of the border, and so we go back and forth all the time. I went up to see him, and we went to our ceremony, and he said, I want you to meet my brother. His brother's name is Joe Hunter. And they have the largest sturgeon hatchery in Canada there. And it is, they take wild sturgeon from the Rainy River, and they bring them in, and then they, you know, have them in their sturgeon hatchery. And I don't really know about the sturgeon sex thing, but sturgeon babies are born there. You know, eggs are, you know, I'm saying I just stayed out of that part of it, but it all happens. It all happens there, you know. And so I went to see him, and they called Joe Hunter. Like, they had this guy was in from the Baltic and the Black Sea. Like, all these cool people were there for this hatching, you know, and I was, like, so in love with them. But they called Joe Hunter, they call him the Sturgeon General of Canada. So I just love that guy, you know. And so, you know, it's like what a great thing to bring back something as great as a sturgeon, right? To ensure the vitality of this relative. So I was there and I was hanging out with Joe with that. Then I had four kids. I was early in the popping off kids section. I've raised six. I'm up to seven now. I have three biological children and then three or four that have come to me. And so four of us, we'd gone up there and so we were looking at him and we were so entranced. I said, Joe, can I bring some home? And he's like, yeah. So we come up the next week and like my four children and one Aerostar van, a bubbly thing that was hooked to, this water tank in some Coleman coolers, right? And it's like, he said, tell me what to do. So I come home up and I get five sturgeon. I get five sturgeon and I put them in those tanks in the back of the Coleman coolers in the back of the Aerostar van. And I say, Joe, what do I say when I hit customs? He says, just say they're your pets. And so I was like preparing. My children and I are accomplished storytellers, fable tellers at customs at this point, traveling across the border many, many, many times, you know, as you can imagine. So we're like, we have our pets in the back, you know. But they didn't ask us, fortunately. I'm sure they just kind of looked at all those kids and me, and they're like, no, we're just not going to get into that car, you know. So we proceeded on, and we came down to my territory and into Round Lake. We put those sturgeon into the lake upon which we live, into Round Lake. And then I went to talk to my tribal biologist. And Larry will notice the reverse sequence. Usually you ask your tribal government before you do something, not after you have done it, right? And so I go see my tribal natural resources department, and Randy Zortman, this is him, he's going like this. He's like, Winona, do you have any idea of how many laws you just violated? You know, he's like, international transport of endangered species. You know, he's like citing these laws and kind of shaking. And I was like, Randy, there's the white man's laws and there's the creator's laws. And they're two separate things. You know, and I'm going to, these sturgeon know no boundaries. And that is how my tribe started. And today my tribe has the largest sturgeon restoration program in the region. And so when my first grandchild was born, do you know what clan that child was? He was Sturgeon Clan. And I didn't pick that. That child came to me, you know? Because that's what I said, is I said, our clans miss our relatives. We are sad because our relatives are not here. Our historic trauma is, you know, meant much. And so I want to be part of that healing, you know? And so I took my little guy down there. I said, look what Granny got you. Your relatives are here. You know, and so it was a good thing. But to me, it was like this, you know, I noted that the Creator noted, you know, what we had done. And that our world noted. And so my tribe is very, very proud of that relationship. But I feel like that, you know, each day, you know, is an epic moment. It is an epic moment. You know, and perhaps now I feel like more that than ever. You know, I have spent the past 4 years fighting pipelines. And a lot of you know me, you know, I don't know how you know me, but like this is not my goal in life, is to fight stupid energy projects. But I've spent most of my life fighting really bad investments and strategies that are forwarded by large corporations and governments that really make no sense to anybody, you know. And so coming to my territory where these pipelines, known as the Enbridge, largest pipeline company in North America, sought to bring to us a pipeline called the Sandpiper out of North Dakota, fracked oil. Everything wrong from the start, from the rape of Mother Earth with the fracking, you know, which you know so well in California, to the idea that our best wild rice beds would be put at risk by a new pipeline that would feed the greed of a Canadian corporation and some American oil companies. And so we mustered a resistance. We mustered a resistance. And we prayed and we had a lot of ceremonies. And, you know, I had this dream that we must ride our horses against the current of the oil. So if anybody knows me, they know that I have horses. And so we began this epic set of rides. And we rode the proposed pipeline route for 4 years in a row on a spiritual ride. And, you know, it changed our life. And we went to every regulatory hearing. We did everything in the white man's law. You know, we did everything we were supposed to do. And, you know, the system was set against us. And then some of our neighbors, the Friends of the Headwaters, filed a lawsuit saying that they had to do an EIS, forcing an environmental impact statement, and on that pipeline. And, you know, the state didn't want to do it. And so then the state, you know, opposed it. So they had a court ordered to do it. The state appealed the decision. You know, that's it's such, you know, like, wouldn't do it. And then court ordered. And when that decision came down, the combination of the social movement, which opposed that pipeline, the money that we had cost them, and what was happening to the west of us that we knew little about, caused on August 2nd of last year, the Enbridge Company announced that it was going to withdraw all applications for the 640,000 barrel per day fracked oil pipeline, known as the Sandpiper. And so what I want to say, and it was one day after our fourth spiritual ride, you know, so I never know how things work, you know, but I know we prayed and we did everything we were supposed to do and we tried and we defeated them in that battle. But what happened is that the Enbridge Company bought 28% of the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's what happened. And so we followed them to Standing Rock. We followed them to Standing Rock, and we joined with, you know, thousands and thousands of our brothers and sisters there. Now, I'm just gonna, how many of you were at Standing Rock? I know some of you went to Standing Rock. Thank you all for going out there, and I know the rest of you really supported us. And I, you know, I just wanna thank you for supporting us. And I wanna say that, you know, it is these epic times. And what I, you know, have felt at Standing Rock, which I feel every day, but it was so clear there, was this moment when all your ancestors are watching you. They are watching you. And all your descendants are saying, you know, hey, what are you going to do? You know, can you sort this out for us? You know, what are you going to do? And you have to summon all of your courage. You have to summon all of your courage. And to me, you know, Standing Rock is really a Selma moment, is what it is. You know, for our movement, our social movement. It is when, you know, we stood against corporations and you know, a system which is so askew, not to say it was ever good, like to say, you know, because coming from an indigenous vantage point, you know, we refer to it as the just us system. I mean, it has, you know, has always been the court of the thief for indigenous peoples. Let us not pretend that we have some semblance of understanding that the system was set up for indigenous peoples. It is not. You know, but in this, what was clear was that, you know, it was clear, absolutely, was that, you know, this is the time when the rights of corporations supersede the rights of humans. That is what is clear. You know, and our system has gone that far. And no, you know, environmental laws are protecting us. And also supersedes the rights of nature. And that is really the task upon us, I believe, is to transform the system. Because if you're going to live sustainably, you must respect the rights of nature. You cannot respect the rights of corporations. You must respect the rights of nature. And so that battle, you know, has raged, you know, and each day, you know, I wake up and I feel like, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm like, you know, hey, Frodo, how's it going? You know what I'm saying? It's like I feel like we are fighting these large pipeline companies, and I feel like it is like this battle, and Sauron is over there, and it is so epic, the proportions of what we are dealing with as evil. And sometimes I just want to go back to the Shire, just over back there, you know? You know, I got a couple places that are the Shire, and then I have to leave the Shire, you know? I mean, y'all know what I'm saying. You know, but that is the time that we are in, you know, and I feel it. And, you know, but at Standing Rock was this moment of consciousness for many of us. And I remember, like, when I was a young woman, I got to be with many great chiefs, many great chiefs. I got to sit in their presence, you know, and Toby got to listen to a lot of them same people too, you know, and we listened to these great chiefs, and at the survival gathering is what I'm talking about, and Mark was at the survival gathering too. But I remember this moment where I sat with Matthew King and Frank Foolscrow. And I remember Matthew King said something, and what he said was, which was so much about Standing Rock, he said, "The only thing sadder than an Indian who isn't free is an Indian who doesn't remember what it's like to be free." I was like, that's it, man. You know, I'm not going to forget what it is like to be free. I'm not going to forget what it is like to be this person that has this covenant with the Creator, which is clear, you know, which is not encumbered by some kind of colonial consumer, whatever that is, you know. And there's something in that that is about that for all of us, is do not forget who you are at your essence, you know. And so as we, you know, as we stand here now, you know, they have emptied our camps. They have emptied our camps. They are pushing ahead with their pipelines of greed. I hope they choke on their greed. Because what I know is that, you know, they don't even have enough oil for those damn pipelines. You know, 900,000 barrels a day is coming out this year from the Bakken. And in 2019, they predict 900,000 barrels a day is going to come out of the Bakken oil fields. So where do you get the oil for a 570,000 barrel a day pipeline that you built out of greed? You know, this is not the build it and they will come pipeline. You know, the Wayne's World School of Pipeline Building or something like that, right? But that's what we're looking at with Trump. You know, he just approved all these pipelines, and we are now facing a 760,000 barrel a day pipeline coming from Canada, tar sands pipeline. So we are reloading for round three with Enbridge, you know, round three with Enbridge. And 2 weeks ago, we had our first State Department hearing, and we all danced. I had to go through the metal detector with my jingle dress on. It was fabulous, as did 50 other women. It was great. It was great. So what does justice look like there? You know, it is a sad time for us at Standing Rock. But 10,000 people were politicized and changed. We all saw what happened. We saw what North Dakota looks like, and do not forget, we call it the Deep North. Everybody forgot and moved out to California from North Dakota and abandoned it. It's true, though. You know what I'm saying? And people flew over North Dakota and said, hey, there's North Dakota. That's where that movie Fargo is from, huh? In the meantime, things went bad. Things went bad. Fear, oil companies, you know, corporate capture of your regulatory system, and racism. And you saw it at Standing Rock, you know, in MRAP, spraying our people, rubber bullets. You know, what I told Enbridge when they came to Minnesota, and I almost got arrested for telling this, was that we hold you accountable for 28% of the bullets, 28% of the injuries, 28% of the arrests, the water cannons, the tanks. You're accountable. You don't get to, I have no amnesia. We saw you, we remember you, and you're here now, and you're not excused, you know. So that's what we said to them. But what does justice look like for there? You know, what I'm saying is a lot of you, if you are arrested out there, you have people that were arrested, go join them and go to court. Do not leave them standing in front of a justice system in North Dakota. The National Jury Project said that 82% of the potential jury pool in Bismarck believed that they were guilty. You know, they're going to convict a lot of people, and I do not want young 20-year-old women to have felony convictions. I do not want our people to do time for protecting water. So if you have relatives, you know, I'm calling for the Freedom Riders to go to North Dakota. You joined us at Standing Rock, come back to court. Let us join with the court. So as I, you know, finish my comments here, you know, I'm going to go home, and I was thinking about these time between the spirits and the present. And before I went to Standing Rock, a little while before, I saw this really great quote. This really great quote in Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation, from Pine Ridge. It was in their annual report. And I was like, can I borrow that quote? You know, I'm a writer, so I always got to I like these quotes, you know. So I was like, can I borrow that quote? And I call up my nephew, Nick Tilson. I say, Nick, can I borrow that quote? He says, yeah, sure, you could use that quote. He says, but I got to tell you where it come from. So I'm going to tell you where they come from, and I'm going to tell you the quote. He says, we was going in Sweat Lodge down at Oglala. We were sweating, these Oglala men, Lakota men. He said, and we were kind of talking smack and stuff, you know, we were talking this and that, you know, who did this, and the tribal council don't do nothing. And, you know, I just want you to know that even in before sacred times, sometimes Native peoples talk smack. I just, you know, because we're all human, you know, and they're, you know, what I'm just saying is just like, I know that we appear to be sacred at all times, but sometimes we talk smack. And so he's, you know, so he said that, we're just talking like that, and we got in that sweat lodge, he said, and he said in that lodge, he said, this spirit came into the lodge. And what the spirit said to us is, he said, the spirit came into the lodge, and the spirit said, how long are you going to let others determine the future for your children? Are we not warriors? When our ancestors went into battle, they did not know what the consequences were going to be. All they knew is that if they did nothing, things would not go well for their children. Do not operate out of a place of fear. Operate out of a place of hope. Because with hope, everything is possible. Time is now. Movement's here. That's what that spirit said to those people. I was like, yeah, that's it. You know, that is it. That is this moment that we are in. And, you know, however you define that, I know a lot of you are, you know, peaceful, nonviolent, and so maybe your exercise is to create where it is we want to go. You know, because we, you know, I do not enjoy my time fighting bad guys, or as Trudeau would say, keeping the beast out of the garden. But someone has to keep the beast out of the garden so someone can garden. You know, and more of us need to keep the beast out of the garden, you know, so that more people can garden. You know, but at the same time, we have to garden. We get to garden. We get to reaffirm our relationship each spring to those beautiful seeds of our ancestors, to grow those things that the Creator gave us. So as I return home now, I'm reminded, a few weeks ago, I went to the Sundance Film Festival with my oldest son, and his name is Ajwak Kapishisit, and he was in a film that was premiering at Sundance, and it was a short film, and so he kind of allowed me to accompany him. And y'all know what this is like, having like a 26-year-old who like, it's like, Mom, you know? So it's like one of those things. I was like, oh, I'm so lucky. I get to go with my son. How exciting. You know, I'm going to Sundance Film Festival. This is going to be fun. You know, so I'm there. So we went to see a bunch of films, and he's like super, what do you call that? He's a critical thinker. We'll go with that. Super critical thinker, right? It's like, you know, every film, this and that, you know what I'm saying? It's like things that, like, I'm learning about how to do, and like the cinematography, and could have done this, whatever. I don't know. So it's like, you know, we get out of this one film, which was called I dream in a different language. When I sleep, I dream in a different language. And if any of you can see that, it's about in Mexico, indigenous people speak a language. And he came out of that film, and he said, you know, he liked it. I was like, oh, thank God, he liked the film. You know, he really liked it. You know, and we both loved it. And he said, you know, the only thing I didn't like is that it had that damn magical realism thing. You know, indigenous people are always like magical realism this and magical realism that. So I've been working on this, like trying to construct and reconcile, like what is magical realism and what is my reality, you know. And so I find myself face to face with this term at this moment in time, because as this pipeline barrels our way, you know, from Canada, I was up in Winnipeg last week saying, hey, you guys, you could like muster a little more resistance, couldn't you? You know, so if you have any Canadian relatives, tell them to like cowboy up or something, you know. It's like, come on, don't like just let us fight the pipeline. You guys need to stop it up there. So, you know, but we have this myth, you know, this story that we have created about this black snake, because those lions look like black snakes. The bomb trains look like a black snake. You know, the pipes look like this black snake. And I, you know, in our teachings, the snakes take care of the medicines. They have a job. You know, we have, like, the snakes are not bad guys in our territory. They, like, take care of the medicines. They have the job. But this is a different thing we're talking about here. You know, and so we have this story about it. And so today, you know, I'm faced with this new pipeline coming our way, a state that is doing a very inadequate environmental impact statement. You know, it will be within their paradigm of accounting, of, you know, geology and risk assessment and mitigation, and you know how they do those things, right? You know, and they will use their term. And so I am tasked with the how you write a cumulative and impact assessment from our perspective. What is our narrative? What is our story? You know, and it is deep and it is long, and you know, I cannot present it all. And you know, so I realized that as I research these stories, you know, to tell, I realize that my life is full of magical realism. So I'm tracking the story of these lakes that the pipe would go next to. And one of my sisters, you know, she is just my age, but she is steeped. She says, you know, there's all those tunnels underneath those lakes that go underground streams that connect all of those lakes in between. And that's where the mermaids live. And I was like, the mermaids, yeah. You know, but I was like, and then, you know, and so I began to hear this story of the mermaids that live. And then on the shore of Mille Lacs Lake, the white people constructed a mermaid statue. So I was like, I guess we got checked off. We're good. It's like, you know, we got reaffirmed there's a statue of the mermaid. But it was so interesting. And I realized, like, my son is over there saying there is no such thing as a mermaid, I think, in his head, you know. But I'm like, there are mermaids. And then my partner is telling me the story as he hung out with a lot of super old dudes, and that there was a merman clan on this reservation, you know. And the story was of this this guy who loved the fish so much, and he would take care of the fish. And one of his, you know, they knew he loved the fish. And then he, one day, someone played a trick on him, one of his, you know, a mean person in the village, and they had him, they served him some fish soup, and he couldn't eat it. But he took a bite, and he knew immediately it was full of his relatives, so he was like, you know, being a cannibal. And so they said that he lay down on the ground, and he crawled to the lake. And then he went into the lake and he came out with fins and a tail. And so that was the merman clan. That's where they came from. And so then, you know, in that story, I understood now. And then the woman who I'm going to speak to when I go back to follow my quest is the woman who is named the mermaid, you know, and she lives there. You know, and so what I'm saying is that this relationship of the eight levels of our world as Anishinaabe people above and below, because remember, we are a people where 50% of our territory is water, 10,000 lakes, islands. You know, we are people that live with these underground beings and above ground beings in this world that is our geography. It is nothing that I can describe for an EIS. I will do my best in the narrative. But it is also this moment when you realize that, you know, it is all of us that are related. And those ones are counting on us, as are these ones here. And it is this equity that is in our hands to care for. And it is also this, you know, this relationship between all of those beings, and then this relationship that transcends, you know, forwards and backwards in time. So that is, you know, the battle that we are in at home. And in this moment that we are in, you know, I'm grateful to be here with you in this epic moment. You know, and as I thought of what to say, you know, I would say, you know, we come from different places, but we are all here together. My son would say that I'm talking about magical realism, but it turns out that that is just my reality. You know, and I'm going to stick in it, you know. I'm 57, I'm sticking with my reality, you know, because that's all I know. You know, so we are all in this same moment. And in this moment, I think that we must, you know, define ourselves and remember who we are and take this moment, you know, to be ancestors, to recognize our ancestors. And then, you know, as I see the workshops that are coming up, to figure out how we are responsible and accountable to the place where we live. Because this is where you live. You aren't going someplace else. You know, this is the place that needs your attention and your love and your reaffirmation and the acknowledgement of all of the ancestors that were here before, because they are counting on you to take care of this place. Be a patriot, not to a flag, but to a land. It is time to really redefine what that which exists, to reaffirm that through our practice, you know. And then, you know, to those of us who are here, because we're a very privileged first world bunch, y'all don't need the lecture on that. You know, but I know that. And so what are we going to do with that knowledge? You know, sometimes we got to get out of our arenas of comfort. You know, we must take our courage and our stand, because, you know, our descendants are counting on us. And as I close, I think of one of the great men that I met, I guess that was 30 years ago. I don't know, what did we figure, 81? We were discussing this technology over the invisible line was Wes Jackson, who you all know, who I consider, like, you know, I love that man. You know, what a great, great leader. And I remember one time he said, and then I had to ask him if I could use the quote for my annual report too. He said, if you're working on something that you plan on finishing in your lifetime, you're not thinking big enough, right? So think of that. Miigwech, thank you for your time.